I'm Deborah Wong.
I'm Bill Delaney. Robin Young is off.
It's Here and Now.
An apology today from the major general who last week took command of the U.S.-run prison system in Iraq. General Jeffrey Miller said a small number of soldiers at the Abu Ghraib prison committed acts he called violations not only of our national policy, but of how we conduct ourselves as members of the international community. General Miller made the comments during a tour of the prison with reporters. More on that in a moment. But first, President Bush, who did not apologize this morning in two interviews with Arab-language satellite TV channels. The president called abuse of the prisoners at Abu Ghraib abhorrent, and he said what happened there, quote, does not represent the America that I know. Joining us on the line from Washington is John Harwood, national political editor for The Wall Street Journal. Welcome, John.
Great to be here.
John, you know, there's such deep cynicism at this point in the Arab world about this administration, much more so than in this country. Images of civilians killed in the Iraq war and of apartments damaged by soldiers making searches in them, and now this prison scandal. How effective do you think President Bush's expression of his abhorrence at what happened in the prison is going to be?
Well, I think there's a reason to doubt that it's going to be all that effective. But remember, he's got a domestic political purpose as well as an international purpose in giving those interviews. There's tremendous pent-up unease on Capitol Hill about what's going on in Iraq. They're starting to feel constituent pressure. And the president needs to show up and down the line in his administration that he appreciates what a serious problem this is and that he's taking steps to deal with it. And one of the steps that you deal with is try to change those negative perceptions in the Muslim world about what the United States' intentions are in Iraq and how they're actually carrying out the occupation.
Bush said this morning, we have nothing to hide. Could that be seen cynically, given that reports of this abuse were completed months ago but not even released to Congress until the photographs appeared on 60 Minutes too last week?
Well, the question is, was this something that was deliberately withheld because President Bush and Secretary Rumsfeld didn't want it out, or were they just inattentive to the problems? It almost doesn't matter, and if the answers aren't appropriate in terms of his actions to deal with this, resignations will be sought. So there's very, very serious concern on the Hill about this.
John, Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld had this to say this morning on NBC's Today show about the prison scandal. Let's listen.
If it's an isolated instance that is punished under the Uniform Code of Military Justice, if it's systemic, if there's something broader than that, obviously we have to undertake the kinds of investigations we're taking to see if other individuals conceivably have behaved that way.
Rumsfeld speak, some might say, that was not really an apology, was it?
No, it wasn't. And they've got a long way to go to convince people around the world that, in fact, the United States is conducting itself in the appropriate way. And rising hostility in other countries as well as in the Muslim world is a very, very big problem for the United States.
President Bush also expressed his confidence in Donald Rumsfeld this morning. Some have said that the chain of command leads to the defense secretary in this prison scandal. And President Bush himself also, in his remarks to the Arab satellite TV stations, did not apologize either.
No, he didn't. And, you know, one of the things, if you talk to his political advisors, they are saying that the president can't do anything that appears to call into question the degree of resolve of the United States to stick with this situation and to ultimately hand over a reasonably stable and democratic Iraq. That is obviously a challenge that appears to be more difficult by the day.
John Harwood is national political editor for The Wall Street Journal. John, thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
As we mentioned, the new commander of U.S.-run prisons in Iraq, Major General Jeffrey Miller, invited reporters to tour the Abu Ghraib prison today. Luke Baker, a reporter for Reuters, was there, and he joins us on the line. Welcome, Luke.
Hello there, Deborah.
Start out by telling us what you saw today. What did the prison look like?
It's a huge complex with very, very tall stone walls on the outside. When you get in through the gates, there are watchtowers scattered all over. There are large razor wire pens, about eight of them, spread out with some with walls around them, most with razor wire around them, high power beam lights. And inside these pens, there are perhaps 20 or 24 big white tents housing between sort of 300 and 400 prisoners. And as we entered the prison this morning in these buses, the prisoners ran forward up against the razor wire fencing, clamoring at us, screaming, shouting, some waving their crutches in the air. Many of them have been injured in recent attacks on the prison. Others shouting at us through megaphones, trying to attract our attention and reading our statement.
And what did they say?
Mostly they were denouncing George Bush or shouting for their relatives, saying that they had been there for months. No one had spoken to them. No one knew they were there. Another said, Mr. Bush, what is this freedom? Is this the freedom you wanted to give us? And it was sort of angry and yet resigned at the same time.
Did you get a sense of what conditions were like, or did you feel that the prison had been sanitized in any way for your visit?
It's really very difficult to tell. We visited one wing, the wing where these abuses by U.S. soldiers of Iraqi prisoners are alleged to have taken place. And there's only five women now living in that cell block. To all intents and purposes, that seems sort of like it could have been anywhere. It didn't seem in any way to reflect, you know, a place where prisoners were massed together in one place. We weren't allowed any very close access to prisoners, even those we saw through the pen were at a distance. All we did hear is that, you know, they have running water. They don't have air conditioning, which may not sound a ridiculous thing, but in Iraq, summer heat, it really is more of a health issue when temperatures can reach 130 degrees. They spoke about how they were fed sort of regular meals and how they were going to be allowed from later this month, two visits a week from relatives. But all these things are promises for the future, the air conditioning and the visits from relatives. So, cut it short, it really isn't very clear how well they live. We weren't allowed to speak to them. We weren't allowed to address them.
Now, General Miller, who's the new commander of prisons in Iraq, gave this tour and apparently issued an apology. What exactly did he say?
Well, really, he said, I apologize from our nation and from our military for the behavior of a small number of leaders and soldiers who have carried out what he called unauthorized and possibly criminal acts against those people detained at Abu Ghraib. And he said later, again, he apologized. He said, I apologize to all Iraqis for what has gone on, for what appear to have been criminal acts perpetrated against you. And he went on to say that I give my personal pledge, he said, my personal guarantee that this will never happen again in Iraq. It sounded very sincere, but of course he was speaking to a small group of journalists and not really to the broad mass of Iraqis.
Did the general say what kinds of changes he wished to make in how the prison was run to try to avoid this kind of abuse in the future?
Well, he said some changes had already been made, particularly separating the authorities of the military police who guard the prisoners and the military intelligence who interrogate and question the prisoners. He also said that they were going to restrict some of the interrogation methods they use. Apparently there are about 50 or so accepted, authorized military interrogation methods. Most of those are being used at Abu Ghraib, but he suggested that several of them would stop being used because he didn't want in any way to create any impression that overly aggressive or abusive methods were being used. As an example, he said one method is called the fear up method, which he said described it as being when interrogators raise their voices and become aggressive with their voices towards those that they're interrogating. He said this would no longer be used. Obviously, hooding, he said, would no longer be used. And of course, he said that the prisoners should never be stripped naked, and they would not be stripped naked, and they would not be sleep deprived either. So those are some of the changes he said would take place, but it will be impossible to know whether they're being implemented or not.
Luke, thanks very much.
Okay.
Luke Baker is a reporter with the Reuters news agency. He joined us on the line from Baghdad.
The prison scandals created a firestorm of comment in the Arab world, but our next guest says the commentary isn't limited to criticism of the United States. Some Arabs are also looking at their own societies. Yusuf Ibrahim writes about that in a new column for the Gulf News, the newspaper based in Dubai. He joins us from New York City. Welcome, Yusuf.
Hi. Good morning.
Well, Yusuf, you start your essay in the Gulf News referring to what I think is universally agreed, the obscene treatment and torture of Iraqi prisoners of war in Baghdad's Abu Ghraib prison. But then the essay goes on to say that this is also causing some self-reflection in parts of the Arab world. Tell me about that.
Well, as I said, it was a cross point in the sense that many people in the region who looked at those pictures mutter to themselves, or not necessarily mutter to themselves, just like I did, wrote and said and spoke about the tens of thousands of Arab prisoners rotting in dark caves and Arab jails, chained to walls, or hanging from ceiling fans and being tortured every day. In other words, I meant it. It's a turning point. We can no longer wait for the Americans to publish these pictures. And I just said in my column, why don't we also publish the pictures of our tortured prisoners? And is that not the right time for a new beginning, a la South Africa style, a moment where we say we got to open the files, we got to look at them?
Youssef, you're a very well-traveled guy, and you think deeply about things. But when an average Arab turns on their cable television and sees these images from Abu Ghraib prison or opens their newspaper, do they go in their minds where you go to the thought of, well, it's been going on in our Arab societies, torture in prisons, for a very long time?
Yes, they do, because the Arab satellites are not as narrowly focused as most people seem to believe in this country. The Arab satellites have a lot of talk shows in which I have participated in the past 2 years, which have raised subjects such as corruption, separation of state, or in this case, mosque and church, nepotism, dictatorships. There is a real ongoing opening of the Arab mind.
Are you suggesting that these terrible events could force a confrontation with Arab society's own problems in prisons and beyond, abuse of human rights?
I'm suggesting more than this. I'm saying that in the next 10 years, the entire area, the entire Arab world, and much of the Muslim world is in play right now. Things are no longer what they used to be. The pillars of stability, dictatorships, nepotism, corruption, all of these things are coming down, crumbling. And I'm saying in 10 years, I'm predicting firmly with great confidence that 10 years from now, many of the governments that are ruling the Arab world today will no longer be in existence.
Wow. Does that suggest that the neoconservatives who said go in, get rid of Saddam, create brush fires in other societies and lead to democracy in other societies? Were the neocons right?
It has nothing to do with the neocons. I think what Arabs are saying, and they're not muttering it anymore, is enough is enough, but let's clean the house. It's like suddenly somebody flicked the button and the lights came on in the room and you're beginning to see how much dirt and filth has accumulated there, and it's time to clean it up. It will not, for one thing, I tell you right now, there is no way a single Arab leader can ever, at this, for the next 10 months or so, see George Bush and expect to stay in power. So this is how much toxic America has become. But every Arab leader is feeling considerable pressure about these pictures, because he knows that in his caves there are tens of thousands of people who are routinely mistreated, and that people are beginning to ask, don't we deserve better?
Youssef Ibrahim is a consultant based in Dubai. He joined us from New York City. Youssef, thanks very much, as always.
Thank you.
Just ahead, we talked to a Boston Globe reporter who has covered Democratic nominee for President John Kerry for 26 years.
And later in the show, looking at the neoconservative architects of the war in Iraq, where do they stand now on the conflict? I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Deborah Wong.
It's Here and Now.
This week, John Kerry's campaign is releasing new political ads meant to introduce the candidate to American voters.
For more than 30 years, John Kerry has served America. As a tough prosecutor, he fought for victims' rights. In the Senate,
but for those who want a more complete picture of the man, there's a new biography out of the presidential candidate. It's called John F. Kerry, the complete biography from the Boston Globe reporters who know him best. Joining me is Boston Globe reporter Brian Mooney, one of the authors of the book. Brian, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Well, John Kerry's really been struggling to define himself in this campaign. Now, you've been covering him for more than 26 years. Who do you think the man is?
Well, he's a very complicated man, and there's a great deal of complexity in almost every aspect of his personality and his public persona. He's a very serious, thoughtful person in a lot of ways, and I think to a large degree his entire adult life has been directed toward this moment.
You write in the book that he had a sense from very, very early on that he was destined to be a leader. Where did this all come from?
At Yale, his friends used to play Hail to the Chief on the kazoo when he came into the room. I think part of it is he decided early in life that he wanted to be in politics. His father was a Foreign Service officer. I think there was sort of a history of public service in his background. His family discussed the great issues of the day at dinner. And then as a young man, John F. Kennedy became president, and Kerry at that time had sort of established a residency in Massachusetts. He was Catholic. They had the same monogram. And I think that's when it began.
Now, there was always this assumption in Massachusetts that with a name like Kerry, he was a good Irish lad, and he never said that that was not correct. But you, for this project, did an investigation that really uncovered a different kind of truth about his background.
My colleague Mike Cranish basically hired a genealogist in Europe who traced the roots of Kerry on his father's side. And the genealogist found out that Kerry's paternal grandmother and grandfather, his grandfather's name was originally Fritz Cohn, and he lived in what is now the Czech Republic, and he was a Jew. And he converted to Catholicism, changed his name to Kerry during a time of great persecution, and came to this country. Now, Kerry said he didn't know that when he was told that. We interviewed him January of 2003 in they call it his hideaway office in the Capitol building. And he also had been told that his grandfather had committed suicide, but didn't know the circumstances. And the research showed front page stories from 1921 that this grandfather walked into the washroom at the Copley Plaza in the middle of the day and shot himself and killed himself. And John didn't know this, and we showed him copies of the front page newspaper story in the Boston Globe that day, and he was just stunned. It was, you know, the veil dropped. It was quite a moment.
Did this strike you as odd that somebody who is so aware of his, you know, destiny and of his legacy would not know something about his really one generation removed?
Yeah, it did. He said he had been told that his paternal grandmother was Jewish, but not his paternal grandfather. Yeah, it struck me as unusual.
Now, the Vietnam War was undoubtedly the seminal experience in Kerry's life. And when he was a senior at Yale, he questioned the war publicly, yet he elected to go. What happened?
It's very interesting. I mean, his entire public life is almost defined by this ambivalence about war and peace. And he was chosen to deliver the class oration of the Yale class of 1966. And he had originally written an empty speech that he never delivered, and at the last moment decided to write a fairly strident critique of U.S. foreign policy in Southeast Asia. Yet he and several of his friends, all of whom probably could have gotten some sort of deferment or out of the draft or get in the National Guard, all decided that they had a duty to go, and the rest is history.
And the history is that it sounds like from the book that he saw quite a lot of combat in Vietnam.
Yeah, during a period of several months, he did two tours, one on a cruiser off the coast, and then he volunteered for the Swift boats, which are these 50-foot patrol boats. At the time he volunteered, he didn't realize that he would be in combat. At the time, they were patrolling coastal areas, and the Navy, after he volunteered for swift boat duty, changed the mission and sent them down rivers where they were literally sitting ducks to draw enemy fire so that they could then call in airstrikes and napalm to clear the banks of the river.
Now, immediately, almost immediately upon returning to the United States after his tour was up, he took a very public position denouncing the war. What happened there?
Became a leader of the anti-war movement. I mean, he describes it as sort of an evolution, and his experiences in Vietnam began that process where he just felt it was an unjust policy. There were free fire zones. There are two instances recounted in the book where civilians were killed by gunners on his boat. And when he came back, he joined the Vietnam Veterans Against the War, which most of whose members were, you know, working class, some quite radical politically, and Kerry became sort of the front man. He was, the well-scrubbed, well-spoken person, and that was his ticket to fame, his famous speech before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee in 1971.
But he alienated quite a few veterans by making some fairly inflammatory statements about soldiers committing atrocities in Vietnam.
He did. In an interview around that time, he used very broad brush language and very blunt language, sort of described American soldiers as committing atrocities without being specific or using qualifying language. He now says the words were too harsh and he regrets it. But he became a polarizing figure even within the veterans movement, and I think we see that today you know, there were a group of veterans now, some of whom were in the chain of command above him in Vietnam at that time, who are now basically campaigning against him. They don't question his service in Vietnam. What they question was his deeds afterwards and the language he used, which even members of his own crew who were quoted in the book say, you know, they were just wounded by it.
After covering John Kerry from his start, when you see him on the campaign trail today, what are your thoughts?
Well, he's become a very mature political creature, and he's quite sophisticated. And I think it's almost a manifestation of what you have to do to become a candidate for president. It involves a lot of compromising and, you know, trimming at times, and I think Kerry is sort of embodies that.
Well, Brian, thank you very much.
Well, thank you for having me.
Brian Mooney is a Boston Globe reporter and one of the authors of the book John F. Kerry, The Complete Biography from the Boston Globe Reporters Who Know Him Best.
Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now.
I'm Deborah Wong.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
No one's driven foreign policy in the Bush administration more than the group known as neoconservatives. They were the intellectual architects of the Iraq War. People like Deputy Defense Secretary Paul Wolfowitz and former Defense Policy Board head Richard Perle. By now, they thought, the war would have been long over and most triumphant U.S. troops would be back home. The wars, of course, played out very differently, leading some to wonder whether the neocons are now played out. Our next guest yesterday attended a gathering of the neoconservative faithful in Washington at the American Enterprise Institute, where leading neocon, Undersecretary of Defense for Policy Douglas Feith, spoke. Gail Chadwick is political reporter for the Christian Science Monitor. Welcome, Gail.
Glad to be here.
Gail, what were your general observations during yesterday's meeting at the American Enterprise Institute? What's the mood among neocons before we get to what Douglas Feith had to say?
I think overall there's a sense of betrayal, that we had a grand vision. It isn't working out the way we intended. Who is to blame? And related, what is to be done about it?
Betrayal? Who betrayed who?
Well, I think the sense is that the president had the vision right, but he delegated too much to lieutenants who didn't share that vision. And it's going to be interesting to see how far the fingers point. I think right now, much of the focus is on Secretary of State Colin Powell. He is blamed for forcing the president into a case for the war that was based on finding weapons of mass destruction, working through the United Nations. Now neocons say, look, that was never our intent. Our intent wasn't to deal with stockpiles that might exist or that do exist. It's to eliminate the possibility that they ever would or that they'd be given to terrorists, and that the only solution to the problem of terrorism is to fundamentally change the character of the Middle East. It's a very sweeping vision, but it requires a level of commitment, they say, that hasn't been forthcoming from all levels of the administration.
So, Gail, how was Undersecretary of Defense for Policy Douglas Feith received?
Well, I would say very well, with some important questions. Remember, this is a group that shares one common utopian vision. Where they're breaking out is whether or not adequate resources have been engaged in that fight And that's where you're seeing some of the controversy beginning. I think one very interesting development was when the Pentagon announced yesterday that it was not going to draw down troops in the Middle East. This has been a request for some time by an element of the neocon contingent. So you're seeing the fight within the neocon establishment moved to a second level. Will Don Rumsfeld now be fingered for not committing enough troops from the beginning? I think that's also playing into the issue of abuse of prisoners.
Last week, appearing before a congressional committee, Deputy Defense Secretary Paul Wolfowitz wasn't aware how many U.S. soldiers had died in Iraq. He was off by 200 or 300.
Very damaging. He said that approximately 500 troops had been killed since the beginning of the war, of which 350 were combat deaths. But there were actually 724 troops, 522 combat deaths. An official later said he had misspoken. But this point of not quite knowing how many had have been killed suggests an insensitivity, I think, that is going to be as much of a threat to maintaining support for the war on this side of the ocean as the images of Iraqis tortured in prison is going to be maintaining any hope for continuing support of the U.S. occupation on the Iraqi side.
Gail, just to finish up, have they, do you think, and from the sense you picked up at the American Enterprise yesterday, have they, could they have reached their high watermark as an influence on policy?
Yes, and I think they realize that. Even those who are now criticizing their neocon colleagues, they realize that because they're going to have to sustain an American commitment to this war over a generation. And as they say, with Bush lieutenants sniping at each other and with the current mismatch between the troops on the ground and what's needed to assure security for the next step forward, between the sniping at home and the mismatch abroad, it's just not sufficient to bring about the vision they're talking about. And they are now talking in terms of months to make this work politically. And, of course, if it doesn't work politically in the United States and in the transitional authority in Iraq, their vision is over, and so is their influence.
Gail Chadwick is political reporter for the Christian Science Monitor. Gail, thanks so much.
Thank you.
We turn now to Walter Russell Mead, senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. Welcome, Walter.
Good to be here.
Gail Chadwick of the Christian Science Monitor just referred to the neoconservatives as utopians. Isn't that a good thing, to have a big optimistic vision of freedom for places long oppressed?
Well, yes and no. In my new book, Power, Terror, Peace, and War, I call the neocons a new variety of Wilsonians. You know, people who think that America can best assured security at home by spreading democratic values abroad. And what you always have with Wilsonians is that sometimes what they will is bigger than what they can accomplish, and they can get unrealistically carried away by their ambitions and their hopes.
How do you think they're faring in Washington at this point, in the councils where decisions are made? Are they being heard as they were 2 years ago?
Well, I would imagine that if a group of neoconservatives came in and told you that if you invaded Pakistan tomorrow, people would greet you with flowers and kisses, they might get a little bit more skepticism than they got 2 years ago about Iraq.
Hmm. Well, let me finish up then with what I finished up with Gail Chadwick. A question. Have the neoconservatives reached their high watermark as an influence on American foreign policy?
I doubt it. You know, even though they've come a bit of a cropper in Iraq, they are potentially, the neocons have the ability to tap into large sections of the Christian right, because the Christian right is often very pro-democracy and very much for American values as they understand them, and not shy about wanting to extend these values to other countries. But the Christian right, like the neocons, is very suspicious of international organizations like the UN. So I think even if some of their policy initiatives don't get the success that they hope for, they will continue to find a responsive public audience.
Walter Russell Mead is senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations and author of the new book, Power, Terror, Peace, and War, America's Grand Strategy in a World at Risk. Walter Russell Mead, thank you very much.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Still to come, Michael Moore is making a controversial new film, but is it too hot for Walt Disney?
You're listening to Here and Now.
Skyrocketing health care costs are putting pressure on state budgets, and the squeeze will continue for the foreseeable future, according to a report by the National Governors Association released this week. Despite signs of a national economic recovery and slightly improved state revenues, the survey warns of tough budget times ahead. Ray Shapock is National Governors Association Executive Director. Ray, welcome.
Good to be here.
Well, last year, many states experienced their worst fiscal crisis in decades, and the thinking was that this year would be better. Is that not the case?
Well, it's a little bit better than it was, but we continue to have major problems going forward because we have obsolete tax systems on one hand and phenomenal growth in Medicaid on the other.
Medicaid costs, what's the concern there?
Well, Medicaid has become pretty much the largest federal program, and it's funded 45% by states and 55% by the federal government. And although it's basically for low-income individuals for health care, it also includes all of the disabled population and about 50% of the population that's in nursing homes. So it's a program now of about $250 billion. It includes 50 million people, much larger than Medicare now.
And is the problem that there are more low-income people covered by Medicaid?
That's right. But the biggest problem is the so-called women and children who are in it are fairly inexpensive. It's the population of the elderly over 65 that are frail, that are in nursing homes, which are costing, you know, $40,000 to $50,000 a year. That's the component that's growing very rapidly, and that's causing most of the problem.
Which just begs the question, what's going on out there? There are just more and more people who are falling into poverty?
Well, that's part of it, but it's the demographics as well. You know, this population of 65 to 85 is one of the fastest growing populations. So that's part of the problem. But just the normal costs of health care is tough. I mean, states have actually cut reimbursement rates. They've cut eligibility. They've cut benefits. But even with all of those cuts, it's still growing at 10 to 12% per year.
So what are states going to do about this?
Well, they're going to continue to cut. The problem is that Medicaid is now 21% of the average state budget. Some states, it's as much as 30%. And other health care for employees and others is another 10%. So you've got about 31% of the average state budget, which is as much as states spend on all education, elementary and secondary education.
I guess one of the options is always to try to raise revenues. You say many of state tax systems are obsolete. What do you mean by that?
Well, what we've got in the states is basically tax systems that were built for a goods economy, a manufacturing economy in the 1940s and 1950s. It has not realigned itself with the economy of today, which is a service-oriented, technology-driven economy. A very specific example. Most states have sales taxes, but most of them don't tax services. So services have grown from 40% of spending to 60% over the last 25 years. That mix in what people buy, and given such a large proportion is not taxed, that slows dramatically the revenue growth. But because any tax reform has winners and losers, it's politically very, very difficult to do.
Ray Shapock is Executive Director of the National Governors Association. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Stay with us. There's more ahead here at... I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Deborah Wong.
It's Here and Now.
Controversial filmmaker Michael Moore is once again battling the establishment. His latest film, Fahrenheit 9/11, is a critical look at the war on terrorism and is said to describe the financial ties between the family of President George W. Bush and prominent Saudis. The movie was supposed to be distributed by Miramax, a division of the Walt Disney Corporation, but now Disney says it will not allow Miramax to distribute the film. Joining us on the line to explain the story is Claude Brodesser. He's a staff reporter for Variety magazine. Welcome, Claude.
Thank you so much.
Claude, basically, what's Walt Disney's problem with this film?
Well, it depends on who you talk to, like most things in Hollywood. Michael Moore's agent was quoted in the New York Times as saying that Mr. Eisner himself called him and urged him not to sell the film to Miramax.
This is Mr. Michael Eisner, the CEO of Walt Disney.
Correct. What Mr. Moore's agent suggests is that he was told, do not sell this film to Miramax. It's going to imperil various tax benefits that I have going in Florida for Disney's theme parks and cruise lines and so on, that because the film is so inflammatory that it might anger Jeb Bush, of course, the brother of our president, and that it might imperil various tax benefits for Disney. And Disney, of course, denies this and says that basically, regardless of what kind of politics you have, anything that is extremely political to the left, to the right, whatever, does not well serve Disney's interests because the company serves all sorts of folks.
What's the buzz around Hollywood about how stinging this film will be?
Most people know what they're getting with Michael Moore, which is a very opinionated and very interesting filmmaker who really has rewritten the rules for documentaries. I mean, documentaries were sort of the dustier corners of Hollywood, to be kind. So there's a lot of money at stake here for Mr. Moore and for Disney, really.
Is it fair to say that if Miramax doesn't distribute this film, someone else will? And in fact, all of this might be good publicity for it eventually?
Well, you can't buy this kind of publicity. I mean, the fact that you and I are having this conversation suggests a certain marketing coup on some level, whether it was intentional or not.
Claude, thank you very much.
It's my pleasure.
Claude Brodesser is a staff writer for Variety magazine.
Artist Maggie Mailer has an idea that could transform a city, and her medium's not paint. Nor, though she's the daughter of writer Norman Mailer, is it literature. It's the empty and boarded-up storefronts of Pittsfield, Massachusetts, a city in desperate need of rejuvenation.
Pittsfield used to be like a one-industry town. General Electric employed over 10,000 people, and they left. And I think the town kind of went into shock and was, like, clinically depressed.
That's Megan Wilden, a volunteer coordinator for Maggie Mailer's group, the Storefront Artist Project, a nonprofit organization that persuades Pittsfield's landlords to donate their vacant space to artists to use as studios. Here and Now producer Emiko Tomagawa went to Pittsfield during an open studios day to find out more.
My name is Maggie Mailer, and the project is something that I actually came up with when I was living in New York. I actually was imagining having a kind of glass box studio that would allow you to engage your own thoughts and creative energy at the same time as engaging the world, the outside world. Then when I got to Pittsfield, it just magically seemed to materialize.
Can you describe what Pittsfield was like when you first came here?
Yeah, when I first got here, I actually counted 25 empty storefronts walking up and down North Street. And, and just selfishly, I just thought, God, those would be incredible studios. And why isn't anyone doing something? And I kept looking for someone who would take the idea and do it. And I think it was like that O. Henry story about the man about town who keeps looking for the man about town, and then someone says to him, it's you. I find Pittsfield a really compelling and beautiful place in its grittiness. Most people that I talk to think of it as a place to drive through on their way to North Adams or going south. You know, I really don't see it that way. It's a great place. It's a working place.
What was the reaction of the people in the town when you first started approaching them and saying, hey, this is what I want to do?
It actually took a long time to convince people. I was given this space in April of 2002. But up until, even back in January, talking about the idea, people thought it was just either gimmicky or that artists wouldn't want to work that way. That was a big issue for people. And I kept saying, well, I'm working this way. and it's really an experiment. You know, I think the project just sort of had its own momentum. And like one landlord would say, no, I don't want to do it. And then another would say, oh, come on, just give it a try. What's the big deal? So the whole city, I mean, it's been incredibly generous.
What can we expect to see at the Open Studios today?
Well, the funny thing is people who have storefront studios really always have an open studio, except that, in fact, people come inside and work in the they visit and talk to the artist. People often put up their work for display, sell work.
But you also have at least one dancer as well? Or?
We have Stephanie Weber is a dancer and choreographer, and she does tap. She's actually giving free jazz tap classes today.
I was working on a performance and installation art piece called Indicator Species that was partly about being observed. So when I found out about the project, it seemed perfect to me to be choreographing in the window where people could see me and I could see them.
And how long have you lived in Pittsfield?
I was born in Pittsfield, and I've come back and forth many times.
Where do you see your work going?
Hopefully my work is just going to bring me more work, more joy, and, you know, just bring me closer to light. Because I feel a lot like in Pittsfield, it's been kind of a dark place for years, and it's kind of been kind of up and down, and I feel like it's moving towards the light now, and I kind of want to go towards there. And I don't know what that means, and I don't know what that looks like, but it's got to be good.
Hi, I'm David Scribner. I'm a writer and editor of the Bercher Eagle, the local daily newspaper. I'm sitting here in a storefront window, right? I'll knock on it. That's it. And there are people walking by outside. To my left, there are my notes for an 8-part book that I'm doing. And I paste up things that I'm writing on the window so that people can read them as I'm writing them. They actually comment on them. I hear what people have to say. So that's interesting, too. It's sort of like, I guess, what Dickens went through when he would try to overhear what people were thinking about his latest serialized chapter. And then maybe would change it. But I haven't so far changed things.
Sitting in the storefront window, as you have for a while, how do you see the city of Pittsfield changing?
Well, the city, you know, it's not bricks and mortar. It's people. And I think what's happening here is the city is really changing. I mean, people always say, well, you know, Pittsfield will change and get better, and it never has, but it really is now. And I think in large part it is to the invitation that this storefront project has made. We like this city. We love this city. We're going to show you that this can be a really wonderful place to work and live. And if you've talked to business people who are now looking at buying buildings and so on, all of a sudden they're more hopeful and they're actually beginning to invest and change things. So I think there's a new movie theater going in down the street, which is directly a result of the developer talking to the storefront project and realizing that there's real potential here. You know, it's not our purpose. Our purpose is to do our work, you know. But it's wonderful to see smiling faces. You know, I like to wave to people as they go by, and I was playing my accordion in here the other day, and they were just like, people were just, you know, waving and happy. And how many times on the street can you see people just lumbering along and tense and involved in their own concerns, and all of a sudden they see something a little goofy, and they say, oh, you know, life can be good. So, I mean, you know, life can be fun.
Our visit to Storefront Artist Project in Pittsfield, Massachusetts was produced by Emiko Tomagawa. For more information, go to our website, here-now.org.
To her about Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Deborah Wong.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.